This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Well, you caught us. Today is the second day this week we're not presenting the interview we promoed. But we expect to bring you the interviews on the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship and neighborhood crime watch groups later this week. For today, we have the story of high-tech crime, computer crime. The government, the military, the phone system, the banks, nearly every kind of business relies on computer networks. If you have a computer, a telephone, and a connecting device called a modem, you can join a number of computer networks. If you're a brilliant computer outlaw, you can break into closed networks and get secret information, or scramble the information, or even shut down the system. And that can be a big problem for business and government. My guests John Markoff and Katie Hafner are the authors of the new book Cyberpunk: Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier. Markoff writes about computers for the New York Times. Hafner has written about them for Data Communications and Business Week. They found that as computer crime has become more of a problem, the public image of the hacker has changed.
Well, it's partially a question of semantics and partially a question of two separate generations. The word hacker has changed its meaning in the public eye over the last 20 years. When the term was first used with respect to computers, it was used to refer to a group of people largely at MIT originally who were obsessed with programming and designing computers. And the label hacker was a very positive term. It was something to be proud of. And it was a very small insular community. And then around 1983 in particular, with the advent of the movie War Games, the word hacker took on a new meaning. It began to refer to largely young men who broke into computers, and I think that that is the term that has come to come to the popular mind now. And the old term is now largely lost.
And we tried to be very sensitive about the way we use the word in the book, because we know that there's a huge community out there who take offense at the use of the word hacker to mean something negative.
Give us a sense of what kinds of crimes we're talking about. Maybe we can use a couple of examples from your book here. Kevin Mitnick, what is the crime he was found guilty of?
Well, Kevin started out as a phone freak in the late 70s and early 80s, and his crime back then was your basic wire fraud, actually, stealing telephone service. And then he graduated onto computers, but always refining his telephone, his phone freaking skills, if you will. And by the time he got arrested for the last time, well, we hope it's the last time, in 1988, he had evolved into a very sophisticated computer criminal, where he was actually breaking into computers at the site of Digital Equipment Corporation in New Hampshire, where software was being developed and designed, which was actually quite a feat.
I think some of our listeners will remember the story of Robert Tappan Morris, and he's one of the people who you write about in your book Cyberpunk. And our listeners might remember that he was a Cornell graduate student at the time, and his father was a computer security researcher with the National Security Agency. It's very embarrassing for the family. So what did he do? What kind of computer crime was he found guilty of?
Well, Robert wrote a program that was designed to secretly copy itself through a huge collection of computer networks called the Internet, largely used by academic researchers and corporate researchers in the military. He made a small programming error. It was his stunt was intended to be sort of a Kilroy was there. He wanted his program to secretly take up residence in thousands of computers. It wasn't designed to do anything except to live. He made a small programming error, which caused his program in sort of a Sorcerer's Apprentice style to run wildly out of control. And what happened was is that hundreds and thousands of copies of his programs ended up on each computer, and the computers just bogged down under the load. And computer scientists and system managers all over the country spent days and weeks sort of cleaning up the mess that his little secret program had left.
Now, you describe your book as being about the social consequences of computer networks. I guess what makes networks so potentially vulnerable is that if you get into the system, there's thousands of computers that can be affected, and also, well, really important information that can be totally rearranged or mm-hmm. stolen.
Oh, yes.
What are some of the things that a good computer criminal can do to an information system?
Well, first thing we have to say is that we're not advocating any of this, and the book is not...
you read a how-to guide.
The book
yeah.
is definitely not a how-to guide. We were trying to describe a culture, and we were trying to get into these people's heads and sort of see how they thought and how they acted. But to the extent that a corporation keeps, for example, its business activities on a computer or in a computer network, if that network is accessible from the outside, the information there, in whatever detail, is vulnerable. Kevin Mitnick had a real talent for going into a computer, looking to see who used the computer, understanding where they sat in the organization. For example, he could tell the people who were the decision makers. And then if you have what's thought of generally as super user status on a particular computer, you can do anything with the information on that machine. And he would get super user status on a particular computer, and then he would be able to read electronic mail. And I don't know if you've ever used an electronic mail system. People tend to be very open and frank with the things they send on in electronic messages, and you can glean a tremendous amount of information. Not only can you get at the information, but you can direct the power of the computer to scanning through it.
And Kevin wasn't reading just any electronic mail. He was actually reading the electronic mail that the security people who were trying to catch him were passing back and forth about the chase.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about computer crime with Katie Hafner and John Markoff, authors of the new book, Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers and the Computer Frontier. What kinds of security systems are there to protect a network from an invader?
Probably the best sort of first defense is to actually encrypt information. That is, to run it through an algorithm so that anybody who sees the information in between you and the person you're intending for it to reach sees just gibberish. And that is encryption is becoming much more widely used in commercial systems. It's a good first line of defense, but it's not insurmountable.
Now, one of the observations you've made is that the weakest link in computer security is the human link, and that you've come across a lot of computer criminals who've gotten ID numbers and gotten passwords by impersonating the boss.
Oh, yeah. Well, Kevin's big skill was
this is Kevin Mitnick.
Kevin Mitnick, right, was this phenomenon called social engineering. Another character calls it psychological subversion, where he could, for instance, talk anybody out of anything. He had a tremendous ability to gain people's trust, to get an operator at the phone company, for instance, just to be willing after a while to give up her or his life to Kevin, any information, whatever, that Kevin wanted by the end of an hour on the telephone, he had pretty much gotten.
But one of the things he would do would be to pretend to be the boss or the boss's secretary.
That's right.
And just mm-hmm. be outraged when they wouldn't give him the information that he needed.
Right. In fact, we have a woman in the book named Susan Thunder who was flown to Washington at one point, and she was told that she had X number of minutes to hack her way into a classified military computer. And she did it basically using what she called psychological subversion. She posed as a colonel or a major, and then pulled rank and got the person on the phone very scared to the point where they gave her the password.
What are federal and state agents trying to do to crack down on computer crime now?
A lot. We sort of are, well, I'm of the opinion that in some ways the law enforcement community has overreacted. There was a prosecutor at one point who said that a teenager with a modem was as dangerous as a teenager with a handgun, which I believe is a slight overreaction. There's a lot going on right now. For instance, the FBI, the training school in Quantico has a computer. A course now in how to investigate a computer crime, which is it's a different way of approaching the investigation of a crime than your basic homicide, and the entire law enforcement community is much more aware than it was even 2 or 3 years ago.
In the last year and a half, there's been a national crackdown that was widely known as Operation Sun Devil, in which there were a number of arrests and even larger number of searches in 14 or 15 different states, led by both federal investigators, the Secret Service, telephone companies. Most of the people that they searched and or arrested were young kids who I think would fall into this category that we've tried to describe, not people who are out to make a profit, not people who are motivated by greed, but people who were interested in the adventure that they thought they could get from wandering around in these large networks of computers.
That's right. What motivates these people is very different from what motivates someone to, say, rob a convenience store. It's this thrill of electronic exploration, and some of them are aware that they're breaking the law, and some of them aren't. And those who are aware that they're breaking the law, it doesn't matter. But the question now is does this make them criminals in kind of a classic sense? It's a very difficult question that we're just beginning to start to answer with a whole new body of laws.
Well, Robert Tappan Morris was the first person convicted by a jury under a fairly new law. This is the Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of 1986. What is the act and what does it represent in terms of, like, new laws to regulate computer crime?
Well, this is an attempt to make what in the past has been tampering with computers over networks against the law. We're seeing...
Was it not against the law before that?
In many states, there has been, and nationally, there was no particular... There were wire fraud statutes, but there were no computer crime laws because there were no computers where valuable information was stored. But the world has changed, and the laws are only now catching up.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about computer crime, and my guests are Katie Hafner and John Markoff, co-authors of the new book Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about computer crime with John Markoff, who reports on computers for the New York Times, and Katie Hafner, who's former news editor of Data Communications magazine and also wrote about computers for Business Week. They've co-authored a new book about computer crime called Cyberpunk. What are some of the difficulties of prosecuting computer crime?
Well, evidence is a very ephemeral thing in a digital world. I mean, computer criminals don't leave fingerprints. And so just finding the criminal, tracing an individual who may have broken into a computer at a large corporation back through a web of networks is an almost impossible task. And really, if someone is good, adept, it is an impossible task. In the case of both the Germans and Kevin Mitnick, betrayal was a big factor in getting caught.
Digital equipment, in fact, had not caught Kevin after a full year of trying to figure out who was breaking into their computers, and the only way he got caught was that his best friend, who was in on it with him, got sick and tired of it and turned him in.
Since it seems more and more people are breaking into computer networks, is that causing some companies or some security systems to keep things on paper or in some other form of filing other than the computer?
Well, there's a simple way to. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be on paper. You just have to disconnect your computer from the network. And as long as there's an air gap around it, no one is going to break into it electronically.
An air gap meaning it's not connected by phone or wired to another computer?
That's right. That's right. And in fact, that's what the military does with their classified networks. Most classified information is kept on computer systems that have no access to the outside world, which is the sort of the flaw in the war game scenario, if you will, is that nobody's going to be able to dial up World War III. And I don't think people are backing away from it, but I think people are slow to move their paper information to computers because they're concerned about things like this, and in some cases, rightfully so.
Are there concerns that in the efforts to crack down on computer crime, there will be civil liberties violations of law-abiding computer users?
Well, absolutely. In fact, it's a huge issue right now, at least in a certain circle, of civil libertarians who are quite concerned about this.
What are the violations that people are concerned about on the civil liberties front?
Well, one of the classic ones at a game company in Texas, when the the Secret Service agents came in as part of a search, they literally confiscated all of the computer equipment and related software materials at the company, and they kept them. And in fact, there was the Secret Service was looking for the material related to the activities of one employee of the company, but they almost drove the company out of business by not returning the materials. The company really couldn't proceed with its business because everything that it relied on was gone.
And that's happened in a lot of these cases where computers are seized and practically everything is seized that looks vaguely electronic. Telephone answering machines have been seized lots and lots of floppy disks, and the people who've had these searches done never see them again.
But it's a tremendous challenge for the law enforcement community too. Imagine the problem if you are looking for somebody's electronic mail and it's stored on a large computer which has the mail of thousands of other people. If you're a law enforcement person going through that, how do you separate out the information you can look at from the information you can't look at?
So you think that there's probably new codes of ethics and new laws that are going to have to be created to deal with the new dilemmas that are arising?
on both sides. I mean, I think one of the things that's missing is the sort of the teaching of computer ethics or, if you will, computer citizenship. Most parents whose kids break into systems have no idea that it's even possible to do something. They're still more concerned about the kids. I mean, they think it's great that the kids aren't on the streets, right?
And a lot of
right, and the kid might be at home trying to break into somebody's
right.
system.
Well, and the parents see this. They see the kid up in the bedroom in front of the computer, and they think, oh, how nice. Everyone values computer literacy. But we don't really think about the negative consequences of computer literacy.
John, someone once called the New York Times to confess about a computer crime they'd committed. Had they called you?
They actually called the national desk of the paper, and the call was routed to me.
What did they have to say?
Well, people tend to brag about their ability, and since I've written widely about the subject, and people have seen the articles, they'll call and say, I've done this, I've done that. It doesn't happen every week, but it happens three or four times a year.
Oh, that happens that often. So what do people confess to when they call you?
Well, they tell me I've been able to get into military computers. I've seen...
that they've been able to get into... Not that you...
They've said that they've been able to get into military computers and that they've been able to see military information that is actually very surprising. And I'll ask them, you know, well, let me see it. And oftentimes it's simply bragging. I mean, I think that there's a lot of folklore out there, and some of it sort of rubs off. There's a mystique around computer crime at this point, and you have to be very careful.
A lot of hackers, they love to strut and brag and boast, and sometimes it takes some investigating to bring them back down to reality.
So, John, did you ever write about anybody who called you? Luckily?
I have a number of times. I mean, well, someone called with respect to Robert Morris, which was what led me to identify Robert.
That's how you broke the story?
Yeah, well, I mean, the story is that someone called the national desk and said, I know the person who did this, and they were referred to me, and we had several conversations, and at one point, the person who called me slipped, and he was referring to Mr. X as the author of this program, and instead of Mr. X, he said RTM. And I know enough about the computer world to realize that RTM was probably a computer login, and so I called a friend at Harvard University, and I said, run this program called Finger on the three letters RTM. And he did that on a Unix computer up there, and back came the name Robert Tappan Morris. And that gave me a phone number in Cornell, which I called, and nobody was there. And so I couldn't do much with the name. But then the next day, I had called the National Security Agency to ask them what was going on, and I got a call back from them, and I said, I think I know who did it. And the person who called me back said, who did it? And I said, well, I'm not going to tell you. You're the computer police. We began to have this discussion, and it finally became apparent to me that the person I was talking to knew more about the case than I did. And I thought, well, that's kind of peculiar. This has only happened 48 hours ago. How is it they know so much? And I finally said, well, I think that the person who did it was Robert Tappan Morris. And he said, you're right. And we talked for a while longer, and I was about to hang up, and I finally said, well, it's peculiar. You have the same name as Robert Tappan Morris. And he said, well, it's not peculiar at all. It's my son.
Oh, no, that was the father that you were talking to.
That's right.
So the father basically had to track down the perpetrator, and it turned out to be his own son?
The his son called him immediately after he realized what had gone wrong and said, look what I've done. And so he knew about it that way. They'd actually talked. By the time they talked to me, they'd actually already been in contact with the FBI.
So you became the first person to write about the story.
I was the person who identified him first, yeah.
Right. Such a remarkable story. Have you met Robert Tappan Morris? Interviewed him for the book?
Yeah, we know Robert well. We interviewed him for the book. We've spoken and visited with his parents, and we still stay in electronic contact with Robert.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about reporting the Robert section of the book is that a lot of people wanted to be interviewed electronically and not on the telephone or in person. Robert's former first girlfriend would only talk to us electronically because that's the way, I guess, she felt most comfortable about answering these questions, which is sort of one step removed from the telephone even.
So she'd be willing to type the answers into the computer, but she didn't want to talk to you.
That's right, and it was the same with Robert, too, that he just wanted to answer certain questions electronically, and it's difficult. You know, developing a phone rapport is one thing, and then developing this electronic rapport when you're interviewing someone is another plane entirely.
I guess one of the things that you're both trying to get at with this new book is how computers have given way to a whole new kind of obsessive person, kind of obsession.
It's more than an obsession. I mean, what we wanted to describe was this emerging electronic world. I mean, a community, if you will. And I think it's very difficult to understand this if you haven't participated in it. What we found is a person may live in an apartment complex, and he may have now in this world that we're describing more intimate relationships with someone who's a continent away than he does with his next door neighbor. And that is a sense of community that people have difficulty understanding unless they've participated in that kind of community.
Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
And we've been talking about computer crime with Katie Hefner and John Markoff, co-authors of the new book Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier. And Markoff reports on computers for the New York Times. Katie Hefner is the former news editor of Data Communications and wrote about computers for Business Week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.